This has been a great run for Raul and for me. We've been on the air doing these since about May and have had a lot of fun doing it and had some amazing guests and some great conversations. We hope you've all enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed the show, we'd greatly appreciate it if you wouldn't mind getting on to Apple, iTunes, podcasts, or Spotify, wherever you listen to the show, and giving us a review, putting a little comment in the section. It really helps us with our show rankings and also allows other people to find the show. So thank you. Really appreciate all you who have joined us to listen to the show and made it such a great success so far. And we look forward to continuing forward into 2022. As always, I'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate Podcast, Expert Institute, Smart Advocate, and Hype Legal. It really means a lot to us that these sponsors would be with us for our show from our inception and May of 2021, all the way through this final show of the year 2021, helped us get off the ground, cover some of the expenses required to put our podcast on the air. And these guys have been with us from the beginning, put their faith in us, and we greatly appreciate it. Expert Institute's been there from the beginning. As you already know, is the go-to place for all of your expert-related services for your case, to help you put your case together and to win your case, get the best possible result for your client. Talked about experts' search function, but Expert Institute also helps you do background research, opposition research on the other side's experts. If you ask them to do that, they can pull all the transcripts, trial testimony, Daubert history, and all kinds of other information that exists out there with their proprietary database to get you the background information on opposing experts. Can be enormously valuable in cross-examining the expert at deposition or trial. Smart Advocate, as you know, is award-winning case management software. We use Smart Advocate ourselves at Gideon Asen to manage our entire practice, keeps track of all of our clients, all of our contacts, all of our medical records, all of our correspondence, all the other records. It's highly customizable, so it can be built out in lots of different ways to fit your particular practice. And Hype Legal, Micah and Tyler are doing great work. They also launched their company in 2021, just like our podcast did, and they're really going strong, helping lots of new law firms build out beautiful websites and digital marketing efforts. I would highly recommend that you speak to them if you're in the market for a website rebuild or you're starting from scratch to build out your website and digital marketing campaign. So check out all of our sponsors at our website at Elevate, ELAWVATE.FM. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
So Rahul, first of all, you had a good weekend. Congratulations to your Bills. Beating the New England Patriots. It's a rare occurrence for the last few decades, but congrats.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. And sorry it was at your expense, Ben. But if it's any consolation, you've made a family very, very, very happy. And ESPN is not writing us off anymore. So I'm really happy about that, too.
You mean me by New England?
Yeah.
allowing you guys a rare win?
Exactly.
Well, you deserved it. I mean, the Bills are really good this year, and they're going to be formidable in the playoffs. So before we launch in with our guest, I'm just really interested, and I know you had this press conference yesterday with Ben Crump, the well-known national plaintiff civil rights lawyer, and it's a really interesting case. I read about it involving this 15-year-old girl who apparently got hit with a stray bullet in a changing room at a Burlington coat factory. Are you able to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the LAPD just released some footage. This happened on December 23rd, you know, the day before Christmas Eve. And Valentina was 14 years old. She was with her mom and was trying on Christmas dresses at the Burlington coat factory when the LAPD came in and opened fire on an individual who had a bike lock in his hand, was nowhere near anybody. The fire that was opened on that individual was an AR-15 assault rifle, and one of the bullets went through the dressing room wall, through Valentina, and killed her. And so this is a case that we're dealing with the LAPD right now, and we're trying to find out whether they're going to take responsibility. And so it's really early on in the case. But from everything I've seen, I just don't understand why this happened, how this could have happened. And this family is just in a state of mourning.
Well, the family couldn't have asked for better lawyers. And so good luck with the case. We'll check in with you as it goes forward. I know it'll be probably all over the national media. And it just, from my standpoint, seems pretty crazy. Why would you be firing an AR-15 inside a store? But I'm sure we'll hear from the LAPD what their excuse or rationale for that is.
This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
So we're really excited to have Mark Mandel with us today on the show. Mark is a good friend of mine and an amazing trial lawyer. He has all kinds of incredible verdicts. He practices in the state of Rhode Island and is a former president of the American Association for Justice. He's also written some really great books on trial practice. There's a book called Case Framing, and then Advanced Case Framing, which I have in my hand right now. These are must reads for trial lawyers. They're just really a great practical resource to how to think through some of the most difficult issues that you confront when you're trying to figure out how to put your case together and try it. And I think the thing that I appreciate most about Mark is his selflessness, in that so many lawyers count on Mark to just consult with them, to help them troubleshoot, think through, brainstorm about cases. Many of the big verdicts you hear about, Mark is the guy behind the scenes who's actually helped that lawyer prepare the case for trial. So welcome, Mark. So happy to have you with us.
Thank you, Ben. It's nice to be here. It's great to be here.
So we don't often do this, but I wanted to kind of start with you going in a different direction, and we'll circle back to kind of some of the earlier years or formative things. But I was just looking at the introduction you wrote to your Advanced Case Framing book. And I thought it was really poignant and just a great way to bring us into the conversation. So you started by talking about the very first trial you had, which apparently was a medical malpractice case, which I don't advise, by the way, to be your first foray into the courtroom. But you talked about that, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more. But then toward the end of that, you say, over the years, I have searched for answers as to how I should be doing my job as a trial lawyer. I've spent a significant amount of time trying to identify the questions I should be trying to answer, coming up with ideas as to how to answer them, and then testing these answers at trial. Some of the questions I have thought are, what are the issues and evidence I should be focusing on? What points should I stress, and in which order should I present them at trial? How could I ever find the essential truth of what happened in our case? What specifically could I do to persuade jurors to do justice? The questions were countless. The answers were few. So I think that's a pretty good segue into, Mark, what are the answers to those questions?
So the honest answer is, I'm really not sure, but I have ideas about it. The first thought I have is that the ability to ask the questions is ultimately the answer, because it means we're thinking about it. It means that we're really striving to understand. You know, I mean, each one of us has unique skills and in my case, deficits. And one of the things that drives me is that I don't like to do something. I don't feel comfortable doing something I don't understand. It doesn't mean I understand everything I do. I certainly don't. But I came to that realization years ago when I was in college. And so I've thought about, well, how do I go about beginning to understand? And so I'm always asking myself questions. I honestly think one of the greatest gifts we've been given in terms of our ability to think is that we can ask questions. And when we get together, when I get together with friends, when I get together with my family, you know how kids make fun of you? Your kids make fun of you. It just goes along with being a dad or a mom. So one of the things about me is I ask questions. I love to ask questions. Because, I mean, I learn when I talk, but I learn so much more when I listen. So ultimately, the answers are never be satisfied with conventional wisdom. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's conventional. I remember the very first educational seminar, continuing legal education seminar I attended was in 1976. It was an AHA seminar. It's when people were really first starting to think about why we do what we do. I mean, why? What are we supposed to do, you know? And so much of, and so I went to this program up in Boston, and I was it affected me because I thought it was so different than what I had understood before. And now that I look back on it, I realized there wasn't any basis for anything that I heard that day. Really not. But I didn't know that. But I thought it was so interesting that people were throwing things out, talking about things that were so different. So one, I would say, ask questions, think about what the answers are. It is so critically important. You know, the day I stop asking questions would be the last day I practice law. You know, I've been doing this for 47 years. I am so passionate about what we do for a living, each of the three of us and your listeners. And every day, I mean, I honestly get up, I realize how lucky I am as a human being, and my goal is to learn something new, hopefully more than one thing new. Second is, don't just accept conventional wisdom. Test things out. Try things out. You know, I remember I tried this case in 2006, and I had become aware that it's not about us. It really isn't about us. I mean, I was taught, you know, these great trial lawyers, it's their personality. It's their charisma. It's, you know, they tell their jurors what to do. And that's not my personality. So, but what I've learned is that you need to test. So in this particular case, I said, well, it isn't about me. I don't want to be a distraction. I don't want to control all the energy in the courtroom. I don't want to dictate anything. So I tried some things out I had never done before. All right. And one was, I wasn't born in a suit. You know, I have a tie on today. I'm sort of overdressed. You guys look much better than me. But the point is, none of us on the weekends, I'm not in a suit. I want to be comfortable. I mean, so I didn't wear a suit during the trial. I wore a sports jacket. I had two pair of corduroy pants, and every day I switched the pants. And I had a different tie. I had five different ties, so I had five ties. It lasted 3 weeks. I didn't know if the judge was going to get angry at me, but I don't, you know, I wore Rockport shoes. I just wanted to be real, you know? There's this alpha seat that the head trial lawyer sits at. I've had cases with other lawyers, and they get there early just to sit in that seat, right? It affected me. I got there early one day and I said, what the heck am I doing? You know? So what I did was, our client was paralyzed. He was a 63-year-old man who was paralyzed from his chest down. So he and his wheelchair became that alpha seat. And I tried the case with my wife and law partner. You know her, Ben, Yvette Beauclair. Brilliant person, wonderful person. She sat right next to our client. I sat at the furthest end of the table, and literally where it was situated, I was behind the jury. So they didn't see me until I stood up to go give an opening or the closing, or if I objected, or if I did witnesses, you know, the witnesses I did. So I didn't want it to be about me. You know, I said, I'm really going to test in this trial. And that's scary, because when you test, that means there's uncertainty, more uncertainty than normal. So I said, you know, I had read a study that, and I had begun about 15, 20 years ago or so reading decision science because of my friends Dave Wenner and Greg Cusimano. They sort of brought me into awareness that I needed to learn that, because before then I just survived on intuition, hard work, and probably too small a understanding of the rules of evidence. But I had read a study, and what it said was, it was so interesting to me. It said that if you call somebody a gossip, that may work, but the people who hear it put that trait on you too. So they look at you unconsciously as a gossip. That's why, like, negative political campaigning works, but the person who does it is attributed with the same quality they're accusing the other one of, at least in the listeners unconsciously. So I said, well, you know what? I'm not going to use any negative adjectives or adverbs in this trial, right? So I wasn't going to get up and say, that was horrible, that was terrible, that was wrong, this is awful. I said, I'm not smart enough not to be able to pull that off. But I tried. I thought about it. So I let my experts do that. And I just tried to bring it all together as much and as best I could. Anyway, got a nice verdict in the case. And I don't think it was about me. I really don't, because I downplayed me. And yet I think it was about what I was doing, which is the key. So the last thing I'll say is this. I learned a huge lesson in that trial. So I know that both of you at some point, and probably all the time or a lot, have actually had the experience of feeling like you're in a zone during trial. Sort of like, you know, a basketball player who can't miss. It's all swish, right? That person we say is in a zone. All right. So that case, I'm embarrassed to say, it was, what, 30 years into my career. Was the first time I ever felt like I was in a zone in trial. And the last third of that trial, it was like a complete high. You know, it was just wonderful. I'd never had that feeling before. I mean, I had, you know, I've had, thank God, success before then, but I never had that level, that feeling. It's not a level of confidence alone. It's just that feeling, you guys know. And, after the trial, I tried to understand. Actually, was the first time ever I felt I had a pulse on the jury's deliberations, too. And I actually sort of called about when they would come back. It was the third day with the verdict. I had a feel for the pulse of that. I can't explain it. It just felt. The point I'm trying to make is this. I analyzed that, just like I asked questions about pretty much everything. And what I came away with was, it was during that trial that I first realized it wasn't about me. It was about my client. It was about justice. It was about what I'm doing, I was doing. And I'm embarrassed to tell you, it took me 30 years to gain that awareness. So I'm a slow learner. But the point is, that was a gift. That was a huge gift to come to the realization that it's about my client. It's about justice. So I'm sorry I went on, but that's my best answer to your question.
Yeah, it's a great insight. I mean, I think a lot of people in this profession profess to say that. Everybody says it's about justice or it's about my client, but the difference is whether that's just a vehicle that they're using to try to obtain the result, or it's something that's completely genuine that they're actually, you know, following through on. And I thought your description of putting yourself outside the view of the jury and, like, literally taking yourself out of the courtroom was a pretty powerful symbol of that, because it's true. Most of, I think, lawyers want to believe they're the most important person in the courtroom, even though they're repeatedly stating that they're not. Can you just, so going back to the beginning, and your book talks about, it opens with your very first trial. How did you get to that point in your life where you were standing up in front of a jury trying a medical malpractice case at all? What drove you to get into this business?
Sure. That's a great question, Ben. I guess when my answer would be, my mother was a lawyer and never practiced, but she graduated law school in 1941 from the University of Alabama. She was born and raised in Birmingham. And she just instilled in me a love for the law. You know, she was passionate. And so when I was in junior high school, I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. And I just love people. So I loved Abraham Lincoln, for he was a trial lawyer, you know. And so I always knew that. I mean, is my earliest memories where I wanted to do that, you know. So I came from a hugely high achieving family, leave me out of it. It was enormous pressure. You know, my mom was probably the smartest one in my family. My dad was a, you know, a thermodynamic engineer. You know, he was like, we used to talk about at our dinner table, we didn't talk about capitals. We talked about propane gas and stuff. And I mean, I was like, what? You know, I had no idea people didn't do that around the dinner table, you know. I have a brother and a sister, both older. My brother was, he was a civil rights lawyer in Alabama for 30 years. He was the very first lawyer Morris Dees hired at the Southern Poverty Law Center back when he graduated. He clerked for maybe the best federal judge ever named Frank Johnson from the Middle District of Alabama, who decided many of the civil rights cases in the 60s. And then he practiced with Morris, and then he set up his own firm. His partner was a black woman, friend of mine from college, because I went to school in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to college. And he and Dolores Boyd, who's now, or at least was, a federal judge for a while, federal magistrate. And then Howard, when my brother, when he was 55, said no. And he lived in Israel for 3 years or so. And at 57, entered rabbinical school. So, yeah, my brother is a rabbi in Andover, Massachusetts now, God bless him. You know, my sister was a radiation oncologist for 30 years at Sloan Kettering, and now she's a psychiatrist in New York City. So I was the underachiever in the family. I had all this pressure because I was the kid, you know, so. So, I was just a normal kid. I still don't think there's anything special about me. I work hard, that's all. But, you know, I grew up in that environment. I got 7 C's on my report card in the first grade, and my brother and sister made fun of me for a week. I was terrible. I mean, it was hard. So, and I'm serious about that. That actually happened. So, you know, I decided in high school that, there had to be something unique I could do, something that I could make a difference. And I knew I wouldn't do that if I stayed home. So I decided, my mom was from Birmingham. I decided they put me on a train and I went 28 hours later, I was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So I went to college and it was 4 years after Alabama integrated the university. So it was a different time. You know, there was 0.5% Jews and 0.5% blacks, and everything else was pretty homogenous, you know. And in 4 years, I had this most incredible life experience that I learned so much from. And as a Northern liberal Jewish person, I became vice president of student government and had my own TV show down there. You know, not university, it was a local TV station because I was one of the 6 people or so who led all the demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. So, you know, half the viewers, I think, really liked me and half the viewers had the opposite feeling. Because I would bring on African-American friends of mine and we talk about racism, institutional racism. I actually had a program on how they should legalize marijuana, right? And this is in Tuscaloosa in 1970. At the time, it was the national headquarters for the KKK. Their imperial wizard, Robert Shelton, was from Tuscaloosa. I talked about religion being a crutch. And, you know, that was down. And I don't believe that, but I did. I felt that then. I don't believe it now, but I did then. Anyway, I realized then that it was so important to me. I was out registering blacks to vote when I was in college and all the political stuff. So I went to law school in D.C. And came back home because my mother died and I didn't want my father to be alone. I was going to go back and do civil rights work with my brother in Alabama. But I didn't want my dad to be alone. So I came back to Rhode Island. I clerked for a federal judge here for a year. And then I joined with this other lawyer, 2 lawyers, 1 very established, very well-known lawyer. And we set up the first plaintiff's firm in Rhode Island. And the very first day I started, he gave me 175 cases. I would say a very small percentage of them were meritorious. I had no idea what I was doing. I was totally overwhelmed. The only thing that helped was the other lawyer who had been out 8 years as a prosecutor. He also had 175 cases, similar, you know. And in my cases were antitrust cases, slip and falls, custody. I mean, and I had no idea of any of it, really, honestly, other than for a year of clerking and stuff. So this case came along, my first trial, and it was in 1975. And I got the case because nobody else wanted to try it. It was a very difficult matter. In fact, I had absolutely no causation proof, not zero.
What was the case, if you don't mind my asking?
Sure. It was an eye ophthalmology negligence case. And my client lost an eye because this ophthalmologist didn't diagnose and treat, I think it was glaucoma, if I recall. All right. But he literally lost his eyesight. And so nobody, and you know, to make it worse, I was at that firm 5 years, but I left for a lot of different reasons. But my boss, I was preparing my expert, a guy named, what's his name? He's from Boston. I'm sure he's not around anymore. He wasn't young then. But I'm preparing our expert, and I'm trying to convince him of causation unsuccessfully. And my boss comes in and says, look, try to help him out, will you, doc? It's his first trial. And I was mortified. I said, all right, so my whole cover's blown, right? So anyway, I went to try the case, and the defense lawyer wasn't a bad guy. He was a decent guy, you know. And the judge was one of the hardest judges ever. Later, I tried two or three cases in front of him, and the station fire case that I handled here in Rhode Island, he became a federal judge. He presided over that case. And I remember after this, a couple of years after this experience, I'll tell you, I was in courtroom, and he accused a friend of mine of committing legal malpractice right in front of his client in open court. And it was harsh. So he was a tough guy. He liked me because I overprepared. But the very first thing he did, my very first trial, and mind you, I was so scared. You know those old steno pads, you know, they were about this big. I wrote out every single question I asked at that trial, including, what's your name? I was so scared. I still have some of those pads somewhere. I didn't keep all of them. But the judge called us up to the bench just before we started voir dire. And I'm scared to death. I have no idea what I'm doing, right? But I'm prepared for whatever it is I'm doing. And he said, I just want to tell both of you that I was put through law school by a friend of our family paid for me to go to law school. So I just want you to know, do you want me to recuse myself? And he looks at me. So I said, you know, my instincts, I lived on instincts. So I said, no, Judge, I trust you. I mean, I'm sure you'll be fair. What was I going to say? I didn't know what to say. So he smiled at me. And anyway, so I put on my case, no causation proof, zero. I mean, it was like, I don't know, if I had possibility, you know, risk of a chance, of loss of a chance, it would have been like 1%, you know. And but my last witness was my client's wife. And she was a beautiful person. And I don't remember what I asked her. I just know she started crying. She had tears in her eyes. She wasn't bawling. It was really genuine. And I looked, and two female jurors had tears in their eyes. It was because of her, the witness. So the judge called us in and said what I said he said in his, in my first, the first page of my book, you know, the second book. And they had offered, probably I'm violating a non-disclosure agreement, but I don't even think they had them back then. They had offered $15,000, right? So that's a lot of money back in 1975. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it wasn't peanuts. And so he said to me, he said, look, I don't care. You're going to get a big verdict. Or that's what he said. He said, but it doesn't matter what you get. I'm going to reduce it to $15,000. Because we told him, he asked, what has it been an offer? He looked at the defense lawyer and he said, you may get a defense verdict, but I don't care if you do or not. I'm going to give him a new trial unless you agree to $15,000. So guess what? Case settled for $15,000. I went back to the office. I was so excited I didn't lose the case. You know, I was a miracle. I didn't lose that case. So I don't know if that answers your question, Benjamin, but that's what it was.
Why do you think the judge did that?
Honestly, Raul, however tough he was a good guy. And I think he understood that this doctor really, really engaged in wrongdoing. And I think he cared. You know, my client was a good guy. His wife was world class. I think he cared that they went through that pain. So I think this was part of his attempt at being human, I think. And maybe he had pity on me too. I don't know.
Like flashing back to your change in style to taking yourself out of the focal point of a trial and out of the scene. After doing that, did you start doing that in every trial thereafter?
Wonderful question. So honest answer is no, not that way, not those ways. But what I did was I also realized or came to understand that to me, the two most important traits a trial lawyer has, I mean, obviously you need to be smart enough. You need to have some charisma, some passion. But to me, the two most important traits a trial lawyer has are humility and self-discipline, right? And I came to understand that. And that governs my being in a courtroom when I'm there. I will look around the courtroom, Rahul, when I'm there. I do it at every trial. And I honestly, earnestly am thankful I'm able to be there. It's like, I can't believe I'm here. I'm so lucky to be able to advocate for justice for my clients. And it dominates everything about what I do. And look, the reason I came up with case framing was I needed to understand what it was I was supposed to be doing. And one of the guiding principles of case framing is, I honestly believe this, that everything we do at trial should feel good and right in every single way when we do it. It should feel completely natural, and that it's what we should be doing at the level of having that be a palpable feel. That's why I wanted to come up with case framing. And so I'm not saying I've come up with all those answers, but I think I've come up with a few in case framing, maybe more than a few, that when I do it, I feel good and right in every way. So everything I do in court, I try to have an awareness of that it feels good and right. So for example, it feels good and right to me never to be the first one to go up to the sidebar when there's an argument. In fact, I'm always the last one. All right. Why? Because I just feel that's respectful. You know, I try to show respect to everything in the courtroom. The worst witnesses, the worst defendants, I try to show respect to while I'm hopefully surgically destroying their testimony. The only time I can remember that, for example, this is a very poor example, but I'll give you a better one. The only time I can remember where I wasn't the last one was in a trial I had with my wife, Yvette Beauclair, and now my son, Zach. And Zach, the three of us tried this case. And Zach was doing a witness. And so it was his witness, and there was a sidebar. And we were right near the jury. And so we were walking up there, and everybody else was up there, and I looked at Zach right in front of the jury. I'm literally, we're like 6 inches from this bar where the jury is seated behind. And I waved to Zach, go ahead. And God bless my son. He looked at me and shook his head no. And he put his hands out and said, you go ahead. And I looked down at the jurors, and the guy who became a foreman was smiling at Zach, right? He loved it. So I said to myself, what the heck? It's my boy. And so I went up for it. So I went up before him. And then he went up after me. And I was so thrilled that he had learned that lesson. But I'll give you another example, okay? Because otherwise it's just words when I say humility and self-discipline dominate what I do in court. The years I tried to understand what I should do, because it never felt comfortable to me, when the jury would come into the courtroom and walk in front of us, or when the jury left the courtroom and walked in front of us. And you may say, well, that's a minor point, but I bet you guys have had this feeling too. So what do you do? So for all my life, before I became aware of what I'm about to tell you, I would just stare at him, praying for some glimpse of affirmation. Not that that would mean anything in terms of the ultimate result, but just desperate for reassurance, right? So I tried this case. I can't remember when it was. It was in the last 15 years or so. I'm guessing it was a case I tried about 10 years ago. I don't remember. But I remember where I was. And I said to myself, because what I would do is, at the beginning of trial, I would put my fingers down, stand up when the judge first came in, and I would look down and just say a quiet prayer, but it was partly that I was so thankful to be there. So I said to myself, you know, I'm going to try not looking at the jury when they come in the courtroom, not staring at them. And so what I did was I stood that trial every single time the jury came in and when they left, and I just had my hands down, my fingers down on the table, standing up, looking down. And I wasn't even thinking about the jury coming in. I was just thinking about how lucky I was to be in a courtroom and how the courtroom and how pleased and thankful I was. Anyway, when I sensed the jury sat down or when I sensed the jury was out of the room, I would gradually just look up straight ahead and then I would go do what I had to do, whether it was sit down and somebody else did something or I did. So at the end of that trial, we got a nice verdict in the trial. I was talking to the jurors, and this one juror said to me, Mr. Mandel, you're a real gentleman. And I said to him, well, I don't know that I am, but, you know, thank you very much for saying that. And I said, but why do you say that? He said, well, I'll tell you why. Every single time we came into that courtroom, the defense lawyers were glaring, staring at us, just staring at us, invading our space, making us feel uncomfortable. I felt very uncomfortable. I didn't know what to do. Sometimes I looked back at them. Sometimes I looked out. I didn't know what to do. He said, every single time you gave us space, you were just looking down. I thought you were praying. You know, you didn't invade our space. So that humility to do that and be thankful and the self-discipline not to look at them when I desperately wanted to get affirmation is what I'm talking about. And you know what? Every single time now, I do the same exact thing. So what I'm saying, though, is if you don't believe that's right to you, feels good and natural in every way to you, you don't do it. But to me, it does. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And, you know, you may say, boy, you overanalyze things. And I probably do. I probably do. But you know what? As long as I'm able, in whatever small degree I can, to distill that analysis down to what's real, then why not?
In case framing, it's really, as I understand the approach, there's two major elements. One is the overall case frame, and the other is what you call "I just can't get over it" issues, or the kind of the big issues that tend to be the turning point, decision turning points in cases. And some of those can be favorable to your side, and sometimes they're bad for your side. What you've just described of being humble and always kind and appreciative to the jury and all witnesses, I think the point where that can fall apart for some lawyers is where you get to an issue that's really hard to deal with. It's easy to be that way on the good issues for you and playing on the terrain, the playing field where you feel comfortable. But in almost every trial, you encounter pitfalls, problems that are really hard to grapple with, right? So how do you apply your philosophy and approach to those really, really difficult issues and still find ways to win cases?
Okay. It's a great question, Ben. Let me just add a third, though. And then I'll answer. It's case frames. I just can't get over issues, but equally important are what I call echoes. And the awareness of echoes is what allowed me to finally come up with the model, the mindset, that I think is what I should be doing anyway. Because anytime I came up with a new way to try cases before that I thought, oh, wow, this might be it. What it lacked was the understanding of how to carry the case through from opening to closing. That whole tundra, the whole interspace between them. So echoes are critically important too.
And maybe it would be helpful for our listeners who haven't read your book just to define the three elements. Do you want to do that?
Yeah, I absolutely will. Can I just, yes, so definitely. But let me just tweak maybe by half what you said. I very much in my life want to have kindness. I do. But I'm not talking about kindness in a courtroom. All right. I'm talking about respect. And there's a big difference. There's a similar feel. But what I'm talking about, Ben, is showing respect to everybody. And that may be kindness. But when it's a real bad person on the stand lying and cheating and trying to deprive my client of justice, I'm not being kind. But I am showing that person respect. And it isn't because I respect the person. It's because I respect where I am. It's because I know what my job is. I think I know what my job is. I want to be self-disciplined. And to me, the one gestalt that should dominate what we do in court is respect. Well, obviously preparation and all the other things, but respect. So that's what I'm talking about, okay? So, and there's a big difference. Overall case frames are what synthesize your case together. They literally, our mutual dear friend, Randy McGinn, who I think is one of the great trial lawyers in the world, she educated me when she wrote a comment to my first book, and she talked about the beating heart and soul of a case. And she saw that in my model as for case frames, and I hadn't. I knew what I thought they were. And so really what your case frame is the beating heart and soul of your case. It's the essential reality. That's what I would have explained it as, of what happened in your case. We forever have been in trial trying to prove what happened. And that we should. That's critically important. We have to prove what happened. What jurors want to hear, in addition, critically important, based on my experience, my belief, is they want to hear why what happened. Not just what happened, but why it happened. That's why track record is so important. Other similar incidents are so important. Character stains are so important. So what a case frame does is it explains why what happened. Okay? When I first started practicing law, people said to me, Mark, look for the larger than life issues in the case. And I was going, what are they talking about? I mean, I knew what the words meant, but I didn't know how to find them other than personal responsibility because it was used against us in so many cases, right? But those larger than life issues are everywhere. They're everywhere. I mentioned 23 or 24 in my first book. I mentioned some other ones in my second book. So that's what your case frame is. But there are two kinds of case frames. There's your overall case frame. There can only be one in a case. And then there are what I call secondary case frames. And your overall case frame might be everybody's got to do their job, right? Your second, and by the way, the two qualities that have to exist for a case frame to be a case frame are, obviously, it's got to be relevant to the facts of your case because how could you put it on if it was something totally different? Although Trump sort of disproves that a little bit, right? But so it should be relevant to the facts of your case. But in addition, it's got to be something that has universal application in our society or virtually universal application. So do your job. Everybody knows everybody's got to do their job because if you get on a plane and the pilot's drunk, you're in trouble. So everybody's praying to God. Look, you know when people pray who don't pray is when their life's in danger or their child critically ill. Then all of a sudden people pray, right? It's because when you have no control and you're most vulnerable, that it gets primal, gets really primal. So what I'm saying is that that responsive court, you know, politicians knew this a long time ago. There's a book that was written in 1960, early 60s, by a guy named Anthony Schwartz. It's the earliest book I ever read. It's called The Responsive Court. And it's about reaching people, being persuasive, getting people to understand. And so it's got to reach a responsive court. So case frames do that. All right. Do your job. Know your limits. All the things that everybody's got to know. But it isn't just these well-known aphorisms. Right. I remember in that Casey Anthony trial, you remember the little girl, Kaylee, who died, and Casey was, you know, after her daughter died, she was out dancing and had this Bella Vita tattoo, you know, and she told the cops she was working at some place and they went to see it. And she walked them through two buildings and then she turned around and said, well, you got me. I don't work here. You know, kind of craziness. So during that trial, she got acquitted, right? Her little daughter was found dead, you know. And so why was she acquitted? And so I tried to analyze that because I try to analyze everything, or pretty much everything. And there was her father was very unlikable, George Anthony. And the prosecution made the mistake of constantly putting him up on the stand. It was like they put him up on the stand, interrupt him for another witness. The other witness would do a good job. So they put George back on the stand. And as I understand it, pretty much every time they put him up on the stand, he wiped out everything good that had just happened for the prosecution before. You know, I've done that to the reverse when I found a defendant and I, you know, when they got interrupted, I'd put him back up. So it helped. But what one I was reading, you know, some jurors' comments about the trial because I wanted to understand how Baez was able to do that, the defense lawyer. And what this one juror said, he was actually an alternate juror, and I think it was number 44, right? He said, you know, they showed us these photos of Casey and Kaylee, mother and daughter, and the love that was between them, you could see it. And he said, the prosecution never overcame that. So I said, wow. And then what I got out of that was the case frame I got out of that. Now, I'm not saying this was the case frame. I didn't read the transcript. I just followed it. But to me, the case frame that I came away with was a loving mother would never do that. That's a universal thing. I mean, obviously, there are mothers who aren't the best mothers, and mothers can abuse their kids. But, you know, you look at the worst mothers, and their kids still love them. Not all the time, but almost all the time. It's like this universal kind of thing, right? So they're everywhere. I just can't get over issues.
Can I ask you about the case frames? Do you use intuition and your own analytical power to come up with those, or are you testing those with focus groups or some other, you know, way of arriving at it? How do you determine what the right case frame is for a case?
It's a combination of both of what you just said. It's intuition. Look, I can't draw a straight line. There are billions of things I can't do. I have a small amount of intuition that I rely on heavily. And I say it's a small amount, but I think that's critically important. So all those things, Ben, you know, I don't go to movies anymore, but back when we went to movies or if Yvette and I watch movies, doesn't matter what I'm doing. I'm open to case frames. I'm open to understanding what are the kinds of things that exist like that. So anyway, I was watching this movie, one of my favorites because we're a baseball family, Red Sox family, and a Patriots family, Rahul, because we're from New England too. Maine and Rhode Island have a lot in common. The only difference is we're on the other side of Boston, so we're influenced by New York as well. But there's a great movie, and I'm one of the few people who actually think Kevin Costner is a good actor, but The Field of Dreams, right? So that was one of my favorite movies. Remember, it was the cornfield in Iowa. If you build it, he will come, they will come kind of thing. So I was watching that movie, and I said to myself, so what's the overall case frame in this movie? Right now, when you think about it, everybody in that movie, I believe, maybe I'm wrong on one or two, but almost everybody in that movie was looking for a second chance, right? Kevin Costner wanted to play catch with his dad again. Shoeless Joe Jackson wanted to play baseball again. Burt Lancaster, you know, was it Dr. Moonlight Graham or whatever he was from Minnesota? He played in the field for half an inning in the major leagues, but never got an at bat. Everybody wanted a second chance. That's a universal. Who doesn't want a second chance? I mean, you play golf with anybody who's not good, and they're going to want mulligans all over the place. It's everywhere on every level, right? So when I thought to myself, second chance, so what's that about? Why is that a case frame that has any relevance to what we do? Okay. It's a damages case frame. Our clients are looking for a second chance at life. They're looking for a second chance. They're looking for help because they're paralyzed or they're brain injured or they're blind. They're looking for somehow, as my friend Catherine James says, to have a second life, a different life, but a second life, a real life, you know? So what I came out of that with my, as my overall case frame was second chance, which means redemption. And everybody in the world wants redemption, even if it's unconscious. So that's how I do it. And by the way, the more you do it, the easier it gets, you know? So it's like anything else, you know? I've had, I don't know, Ben, Rahul, 400 consultations with lawyers in the last 5 years, since I started, since these books came out. I mean, friends, mutual friends, you know, people you guys would know and know well, and others. And maybe it's 300, all right? But I'll say 300. I think it's more. But and every time I do it, like I did with you, Ben, you might have thought I was oppressive when I said, you know, please read the books and then send me your what you think the I just can't get over issues on the case frames. But the more you do it, the better you get at it, you know, as in anything else. So when two things about case frames, in addition to what I just said, one is how do you identify them in your case? All right. And what I got out of it, the way I got to understand that, because it's got to feel good and right in every way, or I tried not to do it. Now, I'm not saying everything I do feels good and right. I'm 72. And for whatever reason, I still second guess myself a lot. I'm my toughest critic. You know, I'm so friggin' hard on myself that it's, you know, my wife says, Mark, take it easy, you know? So, but I'm always trying to think about it. So what I did was I was analyzing the O.J. Simpson criminal trial, right? You know, so long ago. And that's what helped me understand how you come up with your overall case frame and the difference between a case frame and an I just can't get over issue. Because if you were to ask people, what's the case frame in the OJ criminal trial? Most people will tell you Johnny Cochran's brilliant one-liner. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit, right? Some people will say rush to judgment. And some people will say police misconduct. Sure, Mark Furman was a racist. You know, he planted the glove, et cetera, right? And even though he testified he never said that word, they had it on tape, some woman from North Carolina who had interviewed him over and over and over again. But those aren't case frames. That is not an overall case frame. None of those three are. Because, you know, look, one person that I know of in the history of the world has tried on a glove that used to fit, but no longer fits because it had been drenched in blood and then shrunk when it dried. That nobody else does that. O.J. Simpson did that, and it was a turning point in that case. But it doesn't have universal application. Even police misconduct, as rampant as that is, unfortunately, in the African-American community, especially men, it doesn't happen to all white people, all Caucasians who are on juries. It doesn't happen to all people. It doesn't happen to all women. You know, my wife can talk herself out of any ticket. I can't. All right? My point is, it isn't universal. So it's not an overall case frame, and by my definition. They are what I call I just can't get over issues. I couldn't get over it when I saw OJ try on that glove and struggle and struggle and not be able to do it. I mean, that was what it wasn't his glove, right? Same with Furman being a racist. I couldn't get over it. But they told me how to identify the overall case frame. Because what do those three things have in common? Those three I just can't get over issues have in common. What's the thread of meaning that runs collectively between those three things? And it's wrongful accusation. To me, that was the overall case frame of that criminal trial. Because of a wrongful accusation, the glove didn't fit. Because of a rush to judgment, there was a wrongful accusation. Because of police misconduct, there was a wrongful accusation. Now, you may say, well, is wrongful accusation a universally applicable feeling? And I would tell you, yeah, I believe it is. I believe if each of you guys gave me 10 seconds, maybe 30 seconds, you would tell me you might not even take that long when you were wrongfully accused of something. It doesn't mean a crime. Ben, it was you who had that cookie, not your sibling. You ate it. You weren't supposed to eat cookies, but you took that. You stole that cookie and ate it. Or, you know, I tried this case in California in 1990 and 91. And the day before in the newspaper, there was this column called the Answer Man or the Question Man or something like that. It was in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was called. I don't remember the name of the newspaper, right? And it was actually an arbitration I tried. It lasted, because it was a Kaiser Permanente trial. I remember our judge used to wear fish ties every day. I remember his name, too. It was Fannin, Collie Fannin. He was a character, for sure. But what I learned in that trial about case frames and was that that and I just can't get over issues was my little client Lisa was an I just can't get over issue good for my case. Intuitively, I began to realize that it isn't just issues, it isn't just thoughts, it isn't just testimony that are I just can't get over issues. It's not just exhibits that can be I just can't get over issues. It can be the people in the case. And when she testified, this little girl, when she asked the judge, and it was like 10 questions, you know, she asked the judge about his tie. And that was when I figured the case was over. Good. Because he talked to her about his ties. This little girl. I had said to him he wears fish ties and stuff, you know. So, but the point is that your overall case frame is the thread of meaning that runs through the I just can't get over issues good for you. So what's an I just can't get over issue? And I'll be brief on this. I tried a case in 2010 against a podiatrist, medical malpractice case. He had removed two small sesamoid bones underneath the big toe of my client's foot. My client was a medical malpractice insurance defense lawyer. Right. And she was ostracized for filing the suit. They literally, some of the insurance companies took away all the business they had given her firm because she filed suit. She had the temerity to seek justice, if you can believe that. I almost sued them for antitrust. Right. But the point is, I tried this case. And the doctor did all these things wrong. But the worst thing he did was he didn't do pre-op x-rays before he did his surgery. So I'm talking to a juror after that, and we got a verdict. And I asked him about the issues. Now, I know, Ben, you know this, and I know you know this is sort of controversial as a viewpoint I have, that my default is I don't call the defendant first in a medical malpractice trial. And you've seen those emails back and forth. And so I didn't call the defendant at all in my case, in that case. The defendant called him as the last witness, which I wanted because I wanted my cross of him to be the last thing the jury heard before they went out. Anyway, what he did was they knew how strong that issue was. He didn't do pre-op x-rays. And so he gave up another issue of negligence to make his failure to do pre-op x-rays causally irrelevant. And so what I learned from that juror, he gave me the greatest gift Mr. Davison, his name was. He said, he gave me two gifts. One gift he gave me was that he told me we knew it didn't matter anymore, that he didn't do pre-op x-rays, but we just couldn't get over the fact he didn't do them. And that was an epiphany to me because I don't feel comfortable with the word theme. I still don't think I understand what it means. But I can tell you what the I just can't get over issues are, good and bad for me in my cases, just like you guys can. And it's pretty, comes to you naturally. If you think of any one of your cases, you'll think of that. The other gift Mr. Davison gave me, because I kept his email to me, he's the one who educated me on July 16th, 2010, that I should ask for money for a jury and tell them what, suggest to them what I think they should do in terms of a verdict. Because he said, this sentence, I yellowed it in this email. He said, as you know, we had no parameters to use for our award, so I can only hope we were able to award an amount that's going to be of real help to her. And I thought, shame on me. I didn't give him any guidance as to what he should have awarded. I was so afraid they'd judge me, even in 2010, that all I said to him was, I know you'll exercise your good judgment and good faith and do what's right. So he taught me that too. Anyway, so that's what I just can't get over issues are. And then echoes are unbelievably important because we all have ADD, you know, maybe not DSM-5 diagnosable ADHD, but no one can pay attention to something forever. And in fact, we can only pay attention to a very small amount in the first instance. So we just need to keep repeating the meaning of our good I can't get over issues over and over and over and over through the trial, because their verdict, their vote for a verdict, it's not the first choice they make in trial. It could be the 1,000,000th choice they've made, consciously or unconsciously. And so what echoes do is they reverberate. They cause the good issues for you to reverberate in the juror's mind. You're good, I can't get over issues. And the way you want to overcome the bad ones, you keep that reverberating too. So that's my answer as to what those three things mean. I tried to condense that because that's, you know, that's two books and that answer.
Right. Well, we've covered a tremendous amount of material. We really appreciate your joining us today, Mark. This hour has just flown by. There's so many more questions. I hope maybe you'll come back on the show at a later date so we can cover some more ground.
That'd be fantastic.
Well, I'd be honored to, Ben. I just want to say, I'm so happy to meet you, Rahul. I mean, I've heard such good things about you, wonderful things about you. And, you know, just for your listeners, I've known Ben, you know, for not too long, but, you know, super trial lawyer and really a wonderful human being. So I'd be remiss if I didn't say that as my last words on the show.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate that. I feel the same about you. And I mean, it's just such a testament to who you are that you practice with your wife and your son. That must be such a, no father or husband could hope for more than to be able to do that. So my wife wouldn't tolerate me working together with her. That has been beneficial to her.
Ben, I didn't say my wife tolerates me, but you're right. Last thing I'll say is, yeah, man. I mean, it's a gift from God. Gift from God. That's what it is.